Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of our discussion of the defense against the Kansas City Chiefs. An incredibly disappointing day, the loss, the injuries. We talked about much of that in part one, and back for part two is my friend Nick Mehta. Nick, how you doing?
Doing great, Ken. I despite the Ravens' struggles recently, I'm still, the NFL is still a very exciting place. I still appreciate having football back as opposed to not. I would always rather have football back than not. Even when the Ravens are struggling, even when they're injured, even when they're having rough games, this is my favorite time of year.
Yeah, the performance this game may really pivot what happens to the Baltimore Ravens this year, and I think we'll get into some of that as we go here. But the team may be at a point where they have to discuss how they approach the rest of this season. They have some contracts that are coming due at the end of this year. They may even decide that it's appropriate to trade a player or two, and they'll have to consider a lot of this as the trade deadline approaches and they figure out where they are. But we did mention in the first part of the pod that the betting public still thinks they have about a 61% chance to win the AFC North.
Yeah, if you're a betting man and you want to go explore that, I encourage you to. I personally would stay away from any kind of AFC North futures bet, just looking at how this division has performed and Joe Burrow injury and the Steelers doing their Mike Tomlin thing again. It is, it's why it's my favorite time of year. It is endlessly, in some ways, predictable, but even the predictability is unpredictable.
Right. Obviously, the Ravens going through now their fifth really injury-riddled season in the past 21 years. The fifth time that the injuries have completely derailed the season. And it may be premature to call it that for this year, but I do think the injuries they've had so far have already put them in serious jeopardy of, you know, winning the AFC or winning a Super Bowl, whether or not, they actually could make the playoffs, which I think is still, certainly a possibility. And the gambling public would agree.
Yes. Go ahead, Ken.
Oh, let's jump in and talk packages here. We don't want to spend too much time on the high level stuff, but I did have one other thing I will hit before we leave the show. In terms of packages, I just want to talk very briefly about what the Ravens did, because they did some things they've never done before that were basically concessions to the fact they didn't have enough defensive linemen who could help them in terms of rushing the passer. So very quickly, they played base defense for 9 snaps against some heavier personnel packages. So the Chiefs play some 12, they play some 13, they occasionally play 21. It's usually, they don't have a dedicated fullback. They generally have a tight end they put in the backfield. But they gave up 2 passes for 29 in playing base and 7 runs for 17. So they were effective stopping the run. They weren't effective against the pass. They didn't play any big nickels, so that would have been Hamilton moving down. Obviously, they did not activate Lowry prior to the game, which meant they really didn't have the back end safety they trust. I'm not going to rehash what we said, but Nick and I talked about the safety position towards the end of that first episode and some of the frustrations I think each of us has in terms of what the flexibility they're not taking advantage of at that position.
Yeah, Lowry impressed during training camp. He was the darling of spring practices, really. Impressed during training camp and continued it in the preseason. And it's somewhat baffling for an organization that is been fine handing undrafted rookies roles in the past and seeing them succeed. Despite having Lowry active in week 3, to not go with him in week 4. And as I mentioned on the earlier pod, to not use Sanusi Kane on defense at all is just a missed opportunity, especially when you've lost our Darius Washington. It's robbed you of the potential of your really good 3 safety sets with Kyle Hamilton playing a more roving, flexible role when he's at his best. Lowry certainly couldn't, it's hard to say he'd step in and be our Darius Washington right away. Our Darius Washington was also an undrafted free agent, though. But the no even attempting of that, I guess, is what's disheartening. Like you said, they're not even using the flexibility that they do have. And now the injuries have robbed them of all their other flexibility.
Yeah, I mean, it robbed them certainly at other positions. And they were trying a lot of combinations, for example, an inside linebacker to find something that worked, but they didn't at safety, where that position has been untouched by injury so far. All right, moving on a little bit. They played some rush nickel, 7 total snaps of this. And here's what's different about it this game. They used combinations that include 3 outside linebackers and 2 inside linebackers. In all cases, by the way, this rush nickel, basically, think of it this way. It's a 3 outside linebacker nickel where you kick an outside linebacker inside, typically Tavius Robinson, to rush the passer on an obvious passing down. And the only guy they had on the field on those plays, again, typically, was Aeneas Peebles. And, you know, it just gives you a better chance to get after the quarterback, and you're not putting a nose tackle basically in there, or Brent Urban, to try and help your pass rush on those plays. And I think we'd agree you probably get a little more from Tavius on the inside. He certainly made some plays in this football game. So the weird thing about it, though, is they used Trenton Simpson as an additional inside linebacker on the field. And he was off ball, not playing on, you know, at the line of scrimmage as a rule. But he was a guy who was trying to find a hole a lot to rush the passer on, in these rush nickel snaps. So that was one thing. They were effective in those, by the way, 4.4 yards per play on those snaps. So that was something. I'll continue on. I want to take your comments here at the end here. The standard nickel, 49 snaps, 6.2 yards per play. We've seen that being the primary Ravens package this year to a more extreme degree than I've ever seen, because they basically are always in it on any down where even the opponent is showing them 12 personnel, largely because that Marlon Humphrey is big enough to handle the tight end being opposite him. So you're not disadvantaging yourself. That might not be the same with Keon Martin, by the way, if he's the slot corner going forward. They use the four corner dime again. I don't love it. I like the three safety, three corner dime. I think the responsibilities are more clear and gives you a better chance to have some zone looks on longer third downs. Of course, they didn't generate a lot of long third downs in this game, but two plays, 6 yards, 3.0 yards per play on those 2 4 corner dimes. And then the package I talked about briefly in the first section, they played a light race car nickel. Now that is a newly minted name. So I always use the number of defensive backs has to be consistent. So they had five. It's a nickel. It's some form of nickel. And then race car is typically a four outside linebacker look with a nickel or dime package, or can even be a quarter if you have no inside linebackers. This time it was zero defensive linemen, three outside linebackers, three inside linebackers, including Trenton Simpson, Buchanan, and Smith, three cornerbacks and two safeties. In their entire 30-year history, the Ravens have never played such a package until yesterday. Now, that actually is pretty easy to check, because what I have to just check for starters is all the snaps where they had zero defensive linemen on the field. And there were entire seasons where they never had zero defensive linemen on the field. So it's actually fairly easy to check that. It's remarkable. You see something new at football every day.
Yeah. And I think I want to go back real quick to rush nickel, actually, because you mentioned only allowing 4.4 yards per play. Obviously that is a lower, only seven snaps, right? That's a small sample size. But the reason that's a small sample size is what you mentioned also about four cornerback dime. They couldn't get into the positions where they could use that. And you could look at their rush nickel setups and look at the personnel on the field and say, yeah, that actually, you know, would be a good pass defending group with Peebles and Robinson rushing from the inside. They just never could get into those situations against the Chiefs. They were constantly in, second and mediums, third and shorts. Going over to that light race car nickel, it is at a minimum interesting to see or willing to try something that does on its face seem pretty out there in this moment. I wonder how much of it was I have an idea versus I don't know what else to do. But I guess we're going to see, I expect, increasingly creative packages and maybe diverse packages out of the Ravens with their injuries, especially along the defensive line, because they have to figure out some kind of way to get to opposing quarterbacks, and their healthy defensive linemen outside of Travis Jones aren't able to do that with Peebles only playing on obvious passing downs.
Okay. I want to give the people out there a chance to try and think about this question for just a second before you answer it, but what sort of play, what sort of down and distance would you expect them to go to a zero defensive lineman look with three inside linebackers, three outside linebackers, and a nickel? Ballpark it for me. Where do you think that what would be the down and distance they would try that?
A third and long doesn't make sense because you have six linebackers on the field. Like a third and really long doesn't make sense because it's six linebackers on the field, but it can't be anything under like 6 or 7 yards. So maybe like a third and 10 to third and 12, but not like a third and 15 to 20 where you need the bodies downfield.
Okay. So I'd be in agreement with you. That would have been my guess. It was like third and 10, third and 14, something like that. And they had a couple of plays like that late in the game after the Chiefs got a penalty or something. It was the fourth play of the game on third and two. Third and two. They put out a 0-3-3-5. Look, go back and take a look at it. I'm not making this up.
I fully you can't see my face. There's an expression of disbelief on my face. Yeah. And obviously I fully believe you. But what's interesting to me then is that was something they came up with during the week. I don't know what else to do. It was intentional, something they came up with during the week. I'm now even more curious to see how they're going to adjust things further with another week in the lab to try and figure things out. And, you know, I know it wasn't successful. I'm not sure how they could have been successful on Sunday.
No, it was successful. It was incomplete pass. I think that might have been dropped by the running back on a throw out to the flat. I'm trying to remember exactly why it went wrong, but it brought up fourth and two, and then they failed to stop him, of course, on fourth and two, and they didn't stick with that same defense.
I meant more in terms of what they cooked up this week to try and stop the Chiefs.
Okay, yes.
Wasn't successful. And, you know, given the injuries, it's not clear what they could have done anyway. But the fact that they came into the game with something that unusual tells me that we're probably going to see some more things we haven't seen before from a Ravens defense with all these injuries in the next few weeks.
So I would also use that as evidence, and I don't want to spend a lot more time on this, that Zach Orr is trying things to try and come up with solutions that might work even with highly compromised personnel. And there's no way he would have tried something like this if he had either Madubuike or Jones available, either one. I mean, he'd at least have one of those two on the field. But you know, the Ravens, you know, were playing extremely shorthanded and maybe this made sense. And they didn't have Aeneas Peebles on the field, which is kind of interesting to me in that, but it was a novel attempt to try something different. Let me move on and talk about pass rush a little bit, because there are a few things that happened in this game. The Ravens actually did not have that poor a game of pressuring Mahomes as I first think seeing it. Mostly Mahomes was just getting rid of the ball hot whenever the Ravens tried anything funny in terms of passing, if I want to just convert it to words. But they allowed 8 ample time and space plays. Mahomes threw for 56 yards, which is not even particularly good. It's about 12 yards below the standard for that, 7.0 yards per play. He threw the ball 21 times with the ball out quick for 160 yards, 7.6 yards per play. That's about 34 yards above the standard. So significantly better there. And then he had 10 plays where he had pressure and still threw for 48 yards. Now, my standard is only 3.5 yards per play on such plays. So he's 13 yards above expectation there and 35 overall plus for Mahomes. That's a good game, but he was only about 0.9 of a yard above. Patrick Mahomes has put up some much better games than that against the Ravens. And Lamar Jackson has had much better games than that this year against multiple opponents. So I guess, good game.
I guess what I saw from Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs in that game is just identifying the best and easiest way to win the game. And that's what they went out. That's what they try and do every week. They actually seem to care a little bit less about having a super consistent identity week to week, but that they knew that was how they could go ahead and win is just getting the ball out quick. And that made it more frustrating when Mahomes did hold on to the ball, when he did feel like he had a lot of time in the pocket. Now they got to him eventually, but it just never felt like the pass rush impacted his game at all.
I agree. That's certainly the way it looked. And yet
partially by the Chiefs design for sure. But also on the moments when the Ravens did have opportunities to get at him, they really just could.
Yeah. The 10 pressures is the 26% pressure rate is not good. The 10 pressures and only 8 ample time and spaces allowed is a good ratio. So, but then when you look at how effective he was getting the ball out quickly, it's just he picked the Ravens apart pretty much in terms of his ability to do that. And it's been something obviously we've seen a lot from him in the past. All right, now let's talk deceptive elements. Orr used 12, this is numbers actually, Orr used 12 rushes of 5+ in the game. That's 31%. He'd been 17.5% through the first two games. Then he was 36% against Detroit, to kind of frame this up. With Jared Goff, getting him off the spot is a really good idea. With Mahomes, it can work. It might not work. He's the best hot reader there is. Goff ain't bad either, by the way, but Mahomes is really great at it. But the Chiefs, honestly, they move the ball pretty well, regardless of what numbers the Ravens threw at him. So when they threw five plus at him, it was 12 plays for 93 yards, 7.8 yards per play. There wasn't any specific one going across where you said, oh, that's the magic ticket, because it was either too few total rushes when, you know, a couple of times they were success, or it was in the 6 or 7 yards per play number where Mahomes is just going to nickel and dime you down the field.
Right. And again, I feel like I've said this three times now, but the Chiefs just very quickly identified what was going to be the plan and executed it. And as simple as that is, that's how you win football games, especially against a really banged up defensive line, a defense that gets even more banged up along the way. The fight that you see out of individual players is always really encouraging in the pass rush. You know, Tavius Robinson again had one of those games where he's fighting for all 60 minutes, but you can see the ways in which the talent level for the Ravens front seven was just not there against the Chiefs offensive line.
Yep, absolutely, completely agree. Deceptive elements real quickly. Off-ball blitzes, they had 11, and that included two doubles, so it's 9 plays. That's 0.28 off-ball blitzes per play, which is in the normal kind of a range. Mahomes very effective there at 10.6 yards per play. That's something we've definitely seen in the past. There was one game, I want to say, they blitzed him 15 times, and it might have been in 21 in Baltimore or 22. One of the years they played actually in Baltimore, and Mahomes destroyed them in that game. I think it was on opening, might have been in the opening game too, when they did that. They used two stunts the whole game. There's something interesting. When you see that the team only has two stunts in a game, it means something to me. It means that Orr has said you cannot call any on-field stunts. Normally they're allowed to do that as long as there's not a blitz. But when there's only two in a game, or saying, look, I'm calling all the stunts this game. We can't waste our time trying to be at cross purposes on how to get to Mahomes. So he's dictating how that pass rush is going to be executed. And they 2.5 yards per play on those two plays, obviously a sample size doesn't matter, but when I see two stunts, at least that's something interesting I get out of it. They tried simulated pressure 6 times on him. That was pretty effective. 5.2 yards per pass. Again, a small number. Mahomes is getting it done either way. They had 2+ elements on 3 plays, 27 yards, 9.0 per play. Not a lot to be drawn from that, just other than they weren't trying a lot of really complex pressures. The most of what they did was an off-ball blitz with a guy dropping. So they were still trying to maintain a fairly low number of pass rushers per snap.
Yeah, so with Mahomes, blitzing Mahomes has never worked in the history of the world. And when you have a beat up defensive line, the other team knows that you're going to go ahead and blitz to compensate. Again, it was just one of the many reasons I just did not feel like the Ravens were prepped as well as they could be for a team they really should know better by now.
But you also just said something that I think it kind of lets the Ravens off the hook in a way that I probably am closer. My needle is closer to. The game is not a particularly accurate reflection of who the Ravens are defensively because they were so shorthanded. Is because you, there's only so much you can prepare people to be ready for something they can't do. Look, I could a number of things I could train people to do that I could maybe do myself, but I can't train somebody to do. For example, I try to come up with an example that really makes sense to people, but. Counting cards comes to mind. It comes very naturally to some people. There's just some people it's never going to work for. And you can't teach them how to do it no matter what.
I guess my quibble and to pick on maybe a particular example is, you know, blitzing Teddy Buchanan from an off-ball alignment a number of times was not successful at all, has not been successful all year, really for the most, I think almost at all. And so that's just one example of something, well, if you're going to do what's predictable in this game, you're sending the guy who's not been able to accomplish that. You know, it's kind of aligned with your point because Roquan's not in, but at the same time, I wasn't happy with how the Ravens defense came out of the gate in terms of being ready for some familiar things to the Chiefs throughout them. I mentioned this in the first part. So I guess that's a little bit where I come back to in terms of the blitzing and the strategy there. It was very predictable that they would blitz, and they didn't blitz in unpredictable ways. So you can blitz according to the rate that you're expected to, but you know, to me, this is just a kind of a Mike McDonald had the magic sauce when it came to his play calling and timing his blitzes. And Zach Orr just doesn't seem to have that quite the same feel for it.
Sometimes it's about tipping your hat to the opponent. And, you know, the Chiefs have some good players along the offensive line. They're not perfect, but they have some good players along the offensive line, and particularly on the interior. And they have a quarterback who genuinely knows how to read what you're trying to do to him and can react and take the most advantageous route that opposes that. And, you know, the more street level the players you're playing are, the less control you have over the game. I mean, obviously you said it in many different ways, the way that, you know, they're just trying to win the game. Well, Mahomes had utter and complete control over that game. And the Ravens just didn't have the personnel to deal with it at all.
It's true. And I don't think that a perfectly coached team, maybe a perfectly coached, but a much better coached team could have won that game anyway. But I did notice these things before Humphrey and Roquel. I was frustrated with them before the injuries started piling up. Obviously, once the injuries started piling up, there was no way to come back from
it. So, and that was, it was fairly early in the game that Roquan was out, second quarter, right? And then Humphrey was gone in the, I forget if Humphrey's gone. Humphrey played three series, so he was gone in the second quarter too.
Yeah.
So it was all fairly early that happened. And admittedly, the Ravens had given up some big drives already at that point, which was certainly frustrating. All right, let's keep moving here. I guess we don't need to go over the fact that nobody had, only three players had contributions to two pressure events in this game, which is fairly damning in its own right. But Tavius Robinson was the one guy who kind of stood out, with the pass defense at the line of scrimmage and then the sack being good plays. I love Tavius Robinson's effort and what he's done to improve himself as a player. But he really stands out in bold relief along with players like Martin and Wiggins in terms of their effort level in this game. Humphrey, by the way, I think Humphrey's playing at a higher effort level. He's just limited physically in some ways that are not allowing him to get it done.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was him against who tracked down David Montgomery, hitting one of the highest speeds of his career, fastest speeds of his career against the Lions. And Tavius, you and I have sung his praises on this pod a number of times. I do it every chance I can because I'm not sure I've seen a player in the time I've been covering the Ravens in his first two full seasons up to now. I'm not sure I've seen as many players take a big of leap from his college tape to what his tape is now. Mm-hmm. I know that's kind of a very specific superlative, but still a lot of players that fall into that category. And just his development is, I think there's a lot of talk about what a good guy he is and how hard he works and all that stuff. That shows up on the field. The Ravens say that about a lot of players. A lot of teams say that about a lot of players. But for Tavius Robinson, it shows up on the field.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, he's told us about his own journey. And this is one thing I didn't realize, but Brent Urban wasn't a zero-star recruit. I mean, he went to American camps and his dad got him involved in that. So the point I'm making is, despite the fact that Brent Urban is Canadian and would not normally have the normal pathways to play American college football, his dad knew how to get him recognized by American college scouts. He ended up getting a scholarship offer from Virginia and playing Power Five football. That's not the story with Tavius Robinson. He started in JUCO, and I don't know if it's actually JUCO, but it's probably lower than that in terms of the level of football played that he did. I think it's at Guelph. That's where he's from anyway. He went to some, you know, very unknown college in Canada. And I'm sorry, Tavius, if you're listening to this, that I don't know what the name of it. And then finally, he got to come to Mississippi State in the U.S. and play at a very high level, of course, in the SEC. And, you know, after being drafted, he's done nothing but impress the Ravens, and I think Ravens fans even more.
By the way, University of Guelph in Guelph, Ontario, Canada is absolutely correct. I actually commend you on that one because I didn't know it. Not much more to say on Tavius. I think we can move on to the individual player discussion.
All right, so let's do that. Now we've hit on a lot of players here, so let's just hit on a few that we want to go back. You're first. Who would you like to talk about?
TJ Tampa. I think Tampa became the forgotten man of the Ravens secondary this offseason, despite I would say a good bit of excitement when he was drafted, and was thought to be, oh, maybe he steps into a starting role next to Wiggins on the outside in his second year. And then the Ravens signed Chidobe Awuzie, and you know, the idea of Tampa starting cooled quite a bit. And then the Ravens signed Jaire Alexander, and the idea of Tampa starting pretty much disappeared. But with both Marlon Humphrey and Nate Wiggins dealing with injuries, he's going to get a chance. You know, if Wiggins is healthy, if Wiggins' injury is somehow not significant, you know, he's still going to get looks in that four cornerback dime that he got against the Chiefs. If Wiggins is out, Tampa's going to be an every down starting outside cornerback. And I, for one, am excited. I think he's not the most athletically gifted player, but I do think he has a good understanding of what his strengths are. And I guess when I watch him play cornerback, I don't worry the way that I did when I watched, say, Brandon Stevens. Tampa almost is a little bit of the inverse of Stevens to me. He's not as athletic, but he is, I think, more aware, and he is better at the catch point. Whereas Stevens was more athletic and stickier in coverage, and whereas, yes, Tampa's athleticism isn't quite as sticky. Very smart player, very aware at the catch point. And so I think, you know, he's a guy that I'm looking forward to seeing. You know, not that I'm happy with the injuries, but other players I'm worried about watching. He's one I'm looking forward to seeing.
Yeah, at the cornerback level, I think I'd add Keon Martin in that group. But yeah, I'm excited to see Tampa get a chance here. And one of the things that I really wanted out of this season, which was looking a little bit less likely when they acquire two veteran quarters like Awuzie, who was, you couldn't pass up at the price, and Jair Alexander, who seemed like a good bargain at the time at the price, was that a player like Tampa was so far down the depth chart, and I had him behind JAD as well, that he would have been the number six corner on the team, possibly even in danger of being cut or needing to change positions early in his career. Because, you know, his speed is subpar for an NFL corner, but I think he's played pretty well this year, and we'll see how this goes from here. I'll bring up a player that I want to talk about. Let's talk about Aeneas Peebles, because his role on the defensive line is like more clear than any other player. But he went in for, I believe it was one scramble and the rest were passes. Yeah. Total of, get this right from my spreadsheet here, 9 total snaps. One ended up being a rush attempt, and 8 other pass plays. The Ravens were pretty good with him in the ball game. So they were able to shut down the Chiefs on third down to a good degree in this game. They only went 5 for 15 on third down, by the way. And then on fourth down is where they boned the Ravens by going 4 out of 4. So effectively that's 9 out of 15 third/fourth downs that they converted, which is the primary reason they destroyed the Ravens in snap count by the factor that they did. Peebles himself, not a great contribution to pressures in this game. But I think the Ravens are going to keep trying him. And I look forward to Peebles and Travis Jones getting to spend more time together when Peebles will get a lot of manufactured one-on-one opportunities.
Yes. And those were missing in Sunday's game. You know, and that's one of the things with Peebles that I don't think people think about with pass rushers is you kind of got to build steam as the game goes on. You have to see how blockers are responding to your moves and develop. And, you know, especially a guy like Peebles who does try and has a pretty decent array of moves for such a young player, but he doesn't get the chance to have snap after snap in his pass rushing matchups and start to break down his opponent and figure out the best way to slide by him. It's really just a matter of I've got to get by him on any opportunity I can because I'm playing so rarely. So, you know, the hope is with more consistent play, he'll be able to settle into more of a rhythm as a pass rusher. You mentioned also the lack of stunts, something that his speed could be, his speed movement abilities could be helpful on. So that's, you know, again, you don't want to see guys injured. It's nice to have guys that you're at least interested in watching, as the depth positions. I'll talk about Trenton Simpson, whose star has fallen harder, you know, about as hard as David Ojabo's star fell when he was a day two pick. Simpson is going to be a part of this. There's really no way around it now with Smith out that he is going to be a part of it. The Ravens, at least against the Chiefs, didn't quite seem to know what they wanted to do in terms of the long term, in terms of linebacker. You know, once Roquan goes down and the game was in the position that it was, it almost seemed like they were trying things with their personnel and trying to just get more information.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code RAVENS at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Their coaching staff moving forward, which I don't think is a bad thing, being realistic about where that game is. Simpson has just not been any kind of the player he was billed to be. I'm particularly disappointed in his inability to rush the passer. This is something that he was supposed to be good at, was getting to the quarterback from the second level, using his speed, his athleticism, agility to maneuver around blockers and find rushing lanes. And it's just not something he's been able to do. And when he runs into any kind of resistance, he just doesn't have any answer for it. And so, it's the Ravens linebacker unit, I think, is, you know, as banged up as the defensive line is, I think the linebacker unit is maybe just as big of a liability, right, because you need them to contribute in the pass rush with the weakened defensive line. And I don't see Buchanan or Simpson being able to do that.
Well, it took a big step backward with Roquan's injury, because he's a huge portion of the talent in the inside linebacker room. And then to have Buchanan take over, I don't know that he's ready to play inside linebacker full time. He's going to get the chance, I believe. But it now also appears to me that he might be hurt. We talked about this in the first episode. He sat out the entire fourth quarter. So he's either hurt, and the Ravens haven't discussed it yet, but they'll put him on the Wednesday injury report as appropriate, or he's not hurt and benched because the Ravens are unhappy with his performance. He didn't play great in this game, and they may have just wanted to look at other people. But the other guy they're looking at is Jake Hummel, you know, a four-year special teams player who's, you know, he's not the answer for the Ravens at inside linebacker. I think we'd agree. And it's a strange move. So let's see how that inside linebacker group plays out. And you know, they still have guys. I mean, they really were six deep at the end of camp with the addition of Martin and Higgins. Higgins made the roster as a fifth guy. He could see playing time at some point this year. Martin could be elevated and take over a large portion of Higgins' special teams role or play alongside him on that unit. So the Ravens do have other options if they don't believe that Buchanan or Smith can get it done. I'll jump in and pick another player here, and then I think we can decide how much further we want to go with this. I think one guy who's getting kind of a bad rep is Mike Green. The Ravens are leaning into the Mike Green hope as much as they can. He's gotten some pressure. He hasn't been terrible, certainly, in that particular category. He's getting some real trial by fire as a run defender. I think that both things are good. I think the fact, if you're an outside linebacker and you're playing 50, you know, 40-some snaps a game, I don't know exactly what his total is. He played 52 against the Lions. The Ravens have played a ton of snaps overall, so he's played a lot of snaps in total. I do have that number, so I could look at it real quickly. But the point is that they're leaning into who Green is and can be. And I think this is something I really like. And if there are some problems right now, there's just no better answer out there, because the guy who would be replacing him in terms of snaps is probably David Ajabo.
Yeah, Green, I mentioned this in the first podcast too. I think more than any other player on the team, he suffered from the Chiefs' ball out quick strategy. Because there were a number of times where he was close, he got a win in the pass rush, and the ball was just out before he even had a shot to touch Mahomes. So against other teams moving forward, teams that do not have as good offensive lines, I mean, you look at the four offensive lines that the Ravens have played to start the year, and those are four maybe of the league's 10 best units. I don't know if I off the top of my head, but something close, top four of the top 12 mm-hmm. units, right? So the hope is he's going to start to play some worse tackles as the season goes on. And that's also going to help him build up the confidence. Getting this number of snaps is kind of what I talked about with Peebles. You can tell he's trying to build off of his pass rushing repertoire. He's trying to use counters and, you know, he's still a young player and he's still very reliant on athleticism and explosiveness, but against a good chunk of the tackles in this league, that will give him a shot. It's just that the first few weeks of the season have not offered many of those opportunities. And so, you know, I agree. He's been getting a bit of a bad rap. And you know, the requirements of him, I do think he's been put in some unappetizing positions as well, having him line up off the ball, for example, is, I just think, a very, very poor use of his skill set, his abilities. I'll move over to Malachi Starks, the Ravens' first-round safety, who I felt had a solid but unspectacular first three games of the season. The Ravens mainly asked him to play center field. He didn't blow any coverages. He didn't really make that many impact plays, but it rarely looked like he was responsible for a complete collapse. Game against Kansas City, I want to go back and watch it again because I felt like it was the one of the more inconsistent games we've seen from Starks, where at times he looked very poised and comfortable in his role in his area of the field, and others, the Chiefs' misdirection just completely moved him out of the way where the ball was going in a way that was uncharacteristic for Starks in general, for me, dating back to his college film. So, you know, he has not been quite the playmaker that I think the Ravens were hoping right away, but I also don't think he has been tested quite that much and given those opportunities similar to Green.
Well, first of all, it's good that he's not being tested. You know, the old thing where, you know, I'm a free safety. It's good if they never call my name kind of thing. He didn't miss a tackle in this game. That had been a problem. The first three games, he had a couple missed tackles, if I recall correctly. Took some really bad angles against Detroit, particularly on the 72-yard run by Montgomery. It was a very bad angle taken. So I kind of would say this was one of his better games, but I would agree. I mean, it was largely quiet. It's maybe even difficult to get a, you know, a target-free game against Mahomes like this. But Mahomes, most of his deep stuff was to the outside. He had a couple throws in the mid-range where he beat somebody crossing the field and whatnot. But not too much really that Starks had a chance to get involved in, you know, from playing the post, certainly, where he's going to be involved. And they, you know, the Chiefs are not short on speed assets right now. Even before the return of Rashee Rice, they have Worthy and they have Thornton, who are both legitimate deep threats that they could have tested Starks with. So anyway, I think a good game for him. I think the Chiefs had a certain amount of respect for him, which was very positive. Some great discussion there on the individual players. I want to move on now, change gears a little bit, go to the mailbag. We got a couple of really good questions. So Dr. Syed is the first question. One of them I think we've already answered kind of in the first show, but is there any potential for an in-season switch of Marlon Humphrey to a safety role and use Starks' positional versatility to take on more of a slot or additional cornerback role? Interesting question there. I'll let you go first here, and I got thoughts as well.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, certainly not Starks at cornerback on the outside. You know, it's if a tight end splits out there, you can absolutely line him up. I think on a tight end out there, he blanketed Tyler Warren on one rep in the preseason. I also don't think he would be the one that I drop into nickel. I think I'm more likely to put Kyle Hamilton in the nickel like he played all his rookie year and keep Starks, a rookie safety who has looked fairly comfortable, if not, you know, superb and playmaking dynamic in that center field role. I'm not sure I would suddenly ask him to change up his responsibilities as he is still learning them and getting fully comfortable in them. But I think, you know, moving Humphrey to safety, you know, Ken, you made a very good argument for it. My only, and again, this is a cop-out, but I would have to see what the rest of the roster looks like, because that's not a move I would want to make out of anything other than necessity in the middle of the season, having not done anything of that nature in spring or summer practices.
Could completely agree, by the way, on both counts, whether it's the necessity of Marlon moving to the back end because he just can't do it physically on the front end anymore, or moving Starks to some other position, because I think the Ravens long-term, Starks has to be their center fielder. You don't want to get in a situation where Starks is a versatile safety in the pejorative sense that he's a guy who's not really a free safety. He's one of several strong safeties trying to maintain all your positions. I don't want that for him. I think his career growth will be as a center fielder learning how to read the quarterback better and having that being his specialty, playing probably a lot of loose bracket ball. The very first game of the season, he put himself in position to get an interception. He just couldn't collect the football. I want to see more of that, but I'm, you know, that's how I will judge a lot of ways his rookie year is how does he adapt to those, that pure free safety role. We got a second part to this question from Dr. Syed. Great questions, by the way. He also said he thought Keon Martin played well, considering his trial by fire. And he asked the question, is Marquise Robinson next? And I think he's absolutely right. Marquise Robinson played fantastic in the preseason. And is certainly a guy who could be among the Ravens' top six corners. He's also a guy I believe the Ravens will lose at some point this year if they don't elevate him. So assuming if there are IR moves, it would not surprise me at all if Marquise Robinson is elevated just to protect him.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's partially because he plays, you know, you have Martin to fill in the slot. If I remember correctly, Marquise Robinson primarily played outside safety in the preseason. Although I felt like we saw him flip into the slot on occasion in training camp, but they pretty quickly abandoned that. So a pure outside guy for depth, you know, it doesn't address what Dr. Syed is kind of, I think, referring to, which is the limitation, which is the thinness in the slot right now. It seems like his question is kind of nodding towards the fact that the Ravens really have two nickel defenders on their active roster right now, one of which is a full-time guy you need doing other things in Kyle Hamilton. I don't know if I would even classify Starks as a nickel defender. It's definitely not where he plays his best ball. He's competent and can do it in a pinch, but it's not something I would want to move to, again, out of anything other than necessity. So it's Robinson, I think, and this is, you know, I think we might get to this topic in a second too. We've discussed it. There's also a case to be made for giving younger guys, undrafted guys, a try. That, you know, you're not benching Marlon Humphrey for Keon Martin, but Marlon Humphrey's out, so Keon Martin's going to get a chance. Mm-hmm. And you know, with Nate Wiggins out, you want to play four cornerback dime. Marquise Robinson might be able to get in the game and get some snaps. And it is, I guess, you're not allowed to say the season is lost and then complain when younger guys are getting snaps is my thinking, right? So if the season, you know, and for the time being, those younger guys are going to be getting the snaps anyway. So I think that it's, I think what did Dr. Syed say? Baptism by fire, trial by fire. Good. We've seen Ravens defenders rise to the challenge before. We've seen them struggle and bounce back. But I think with all the injuries, you know, I don't see it as an opportunity. But you can take the opportunity that it presents.
Yeah, I'm extremely excited about the possibility of Marquise Robinson getting a shot. And the one extra thing I would point to is that Marquise Robinson is not on a scholarship here. And next year he'll be recompeting with players, and those guys will be completing as well, like Longerbeam and Kone, who had a draft status originally attached to them, where Marquise Robinson did not. So there's definitely a possibility that he's going to be not have a seat in this game of musical chairs, plus, you know, any additional Ravens draft picks that would be in lower rounds, let alone the higher round picks that are certain to keep their spots. So you know, there's going to be a lot of competition next year, and it'd be nice to see have some body of evidence, body of play for Marquise Robinson. Let me go on to another question here. Work off the assumption that Beeks is done for the year and done for his career, A and B. How do you manage assets? Do you trade draft capital for a defensive tackle? Do you sign Travis Jones to a more player-friendly contract because you lost Beeks?
So to give the salary cap background on Matt Ibike, he does have, I believe, $22 million of his $26 million salary guaranteed for the 2026 season. But the Ravens would not have to pay him that if he were to retire. It would only be about the signing and option bonus prorations that they've already paid to him and still have to account for on the cap. So that's just one important note when it comes to that big salary, that it has already been guaranteed, but that does not apply if the player retires.
And that tells you he would not retire, is what that tells me. Because if he's got a guaranteed salary of $22 million, he's gonna take that.
I can't pretend to know why players make certain decisions. I saw Derek Carr hand back a ridiculous amount of money earlier this year, and I know Madubuike is a much younger player, but I can't even pretend to get into what how that's going to all play out. I'm just giving the numbers, right? More to the point, you know, I think with Travis Jones, very, very clearly he wanted to bet on himself in this year the same way that Madubuike did and cashed out as a result of it. The problem is that Jones isn't going to have the opportunity to cash out in the same way that Madubuike did because he doesn't have someone playing next to him that frees him up to make plays. It's kind of like a great lineup in baseball. You need someone to protect your four-hitter. You need your three-hitter to protect your four-hitter and vice versa. I guess the four protects the three. But yeah, regardless, that's why Madubuike and Jones work so well because defenses had to choose which one of them they were going to leave one-on-one and have a high risk of losing that encounter. Jones is just not going to have that opportunity the rest of this year. He is going to get swallowed up by double teams on almost every play. We've seen it in the last 2 weeks. And so in a weird way, you might not have to go overpay Travis Jones by the end. You're not going to do it during this. I don't think they do it during this season. It just doesn't seem like it's in the cards. They really have rarely gotten extensions done during the season, and it hasn't been in situations where the gap between team and player is as big as this one could be. But I don't think Jones is going to be able to rack up the statistics, the production that is going to get him maybe in the upper echelon of defensive linemen and give the Ravens a chance to keep him on maybe a medium deal that isn't particularly team or player friendly.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, as far as extensions go, they've done a bunch of them in December in recent years. So they got Roquan Smith and Michael Pierce was done in December. So they've had some, and I think they have so many players this year, they would be wise not to leave it for the end of the season. They need to figure out who they can get and make multiple offers like you do for draft picks 10 through 20 in the Major League Baseball draft. And whoever takes their offer first is good. And they just won't be able to keep everybody. That's the nature of this. I am a little concerned and I don't know the answer, but it's for a future Friday morning GM show anyway, as to how Madubuike departing from the Ravens might impact their cap in current years or what extendability or malleability that cap would have. So I want to look into that a little more before I opine on that. As far as draft capital, I would definitely hoard additional draft capital for the defensive line. And this was a great defensive line draft. In a way, it was kind of sad that all they got was Aeneas Peebles, although I think he was a value in the sixth round. I think the pick that went to Carson Vinson, they had multiple options of guys they could have taken on the defensive line at that point. That would have been reasonable choices. I still love the Vincent pick, by the way, but it's there were multiple guys that could have been reasonable at that point. All right, one last question here from the mailbag, and that is, should the Ravens become sellers? So, the nice thing about expiring contracts is they lend themselves well to rental decisions. So could the Ravens trade a Mark Andrews, you want to go to an extreme level, they could trade Tyler Linderbaum. And he's a player who would have, I think, potentially immense value to somebody who has an offensive line problem they need to fix for the playoffs in 2025 if the Ravens are willing to give that up and give the job to Corey Bullock a year early.
It's a very specific need a team would have to have is why I'm just doubtful that it pops up. But by the trade deadline, would be absolutely in favor of getting back solid draft capital for a player who has not proven that he is worth the highest center contract in the NFL so far this year. He just hasn't played up to that level, in my opinion. I know that the guard play next to him hasn't been stellar, but that's kind of the point of having a really good center, is that it helps out your guard play, and he just hasn't been doing that, unfortunately. And so, it's, again, I know this is a cop-out, but it's too early to make that call. What you should do is what Ken is doing, is explore the options and be prepared, right? And don't rule anything out. Another player that, I've talked about his, consistent but not spectacular play is Adafe Owe. Absolutely a player that I don't envision them re-signing at all. Linderbaum, maybe. Owe, absolutely not. And so that is a player that they could absolutely go dangle on the trade market. If the season is really going down the drain by the trade deadline, you might be a friend to Kyle Van Noy and go send him to a team that he can get in the playoffs and go compete with. It seems like he is that might be a route that he wants to take, and the Ravens would be willing to oblige if they can get the draft capital for it. I think you said Mark Andrews a minute ago, Ken. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of options there. But the answer, should they become sellers, is a question that's impossible to answer right now, in my opinion. The only thing you can do is look at your roster and be prepared and be willing to consider anything by the time the deadline rolls around.
Yeah, I don't think that you need to make the decision right now. I think you make the decision in mid to late October, but you need to be prepared to make the decision. You need to be prepared to say, what do I want if I have to trade this player? And then basically look at it again when the time comes and adjust what you think they're going to bring after the season in terms of a comp pick, present value that, because remember, that's a year later you get that. You take additional risk with them playing well for their new team, because that's part of the formula in terms of what comp pick you get. So, you know, I don't think there's a big pick on the line for Linderbaum. It's a 4 or a 5. It's one of the two that they probably will get back for Tyler Linderbaum if they allow him to walk. Probably a 4, but even if that's the case, you got to be very careful about that. If somebody offers you it wouldn't be a high 3. It would probably have to be a low 2 or a 3 and something else, like a 3 and a 5 or a 3 and a 6. Do you want to take that kind of a return for Tyler at the trade deadline this year? I think you have to consider it, and you have to be ready to make that move.
Yeah, and I guess I'm just peeking at the roster and the contract table here right now. A team might want a cheap cornerback like Cheeto. A contender mm-hmm. might want a cheap cornerback like Cheeto. Jair, I think it's impossible to say anything one way or the other. We mentioned Owe Van Noy, Linderbaum, Andrews, and I think the one that you really might have to think about and is one I couldn't possibly answer right now is Travis Jones. If you are not going to extend, if you know you're not going to extend Travis Jones, if you are already very confident in that fact and the season is going down the drain by the trade deadline and someone calls and offers you a second round pick for Travis Jones, this is where it gets really complicated. I'm smiling because I'm thinking of how complicated this gets, so I'll try and keep it short. But we were talking about how you need Jones and Madubuike protected each other. And you were talking about how players can go to another team and play better and get a higher comp pick than they were expecting. Jones seems like a case where that could happen, where he would actually go to another team that has another interior rusher, and he could actually boost his value to where he wants it to be by the time he hits free agency. I don't know how the logistics of the trade values and what would make sense for him would do. That would probably be the most extreme possible example of a sell this year. I can't think of a
Isaiah that's probably, Likely.
What?
Isaiah Likely.
Likely would be a very, but see, I don't think that's even on the table. I'm just not sure that's on the table because that's a player they know they want to keep.
Well, and they've made him an offer. And if he thinks, you know, he's worth $6 million more a year and now he's been hurt, but he's back. And if he starts, I mean, did he catch a ball in this first game back? I don't know. So, you know, he's got to get back to some level of productivity this year, both in terms of catching the ball. And I think, you know, showing that blocking productivity he's had typically in the past for the Ravens really get excited about re-signing him to a big money contract. And then, you know, I'm sure he's a very comfortable safety blanket for Lamar, so they might want to do that. But all those guys are on the table. I mean, if this season is really going down the toilet, then all those guys are on the table in terms of what you got to be willing to consider.
I think Likely and Jones are the two extreme ones. I think there are the other veterans and Owe on the fifth year option are very, very logical options to move. If the team is even at a point where it's hard to see this team selling while they still believe they can make the playoffs.
Right.
But there's still an argument for getting the surplus value out of an Owe, Chidobe, Van Noy, Mark Andrews trade at the trade deadline to build towards the future. Even if you take that hit on your current roster, this is one of the things that makes the NFL endlessly fascinating, Ken, all these variables interacting and, you know, it's given me so many extra things to think about in terms of approaching the rest of the season. it really is a fascinating, very unfortunate, but fascinating conundrum.
You know, one of the things that is really interesting about what happened in this Chiefs game is all the injuries. This is a time, in a sense, for Ravens fans to be thankful for what's happened, because the Ravens, even keeled, play at a level, is really rewarded at times like this more than any other time. And like I've said, they've had five injury-riddled years in the last 21. That's almost 25% of the time that happens. There's nothing you can really do about it. It's not really related to anything the organization has control over. It just happens when it happens. And, you know, I'm not going to say zero control, but there's very little control in terms of what the organization can do to reduce the risk of very key injuries hitting some of their star players. So when it does happen, you're thankful you didn't make big investments. I've seen some people take the opposite point, by the way, in this last 24 hours, but I'll point to one particular trade the Ravens could have made. The Ravens could have traded their next two first-round picks, maybe a player, maybe not, because they got Dallas got a defensive lineman back, and gotten Micah Parsons in the same way. So I don't even know who the defensive lineman they would have traded would have been, because it seems like Jones and Madubuike would be completely out of the question, and the Ravens don't really have anybody else that they could have offered. But if they traded for Micah Parsons, given him the same contract the Packers did, and had this happen, it would have been the biggest mistake imaginable. It would have been just an enormous mistake. And the Ravens, their fans ought to be very happy that the Ravens play at a very level, even keel, that allows them to avoid those kind of very serious contract blunders. The Eagles have been remarkably lucky with all the void years they plunged into contracts, and it's worked out for them. They've been clever, but also very lucky. In the case of the Browns, they've been somewhat clever and completely unlucky, and they haven't made it work with the Deshaun Watson contract in particular, but all the other extensions that they've done to push the cap off into the future have put them equally in debt, or almost at the level of the Eagles in debt, but without any of the return in terms of postseason honors.
You call it unlucky. I call it karma. And poor player evaluation. But regardless, yeah, I think you're very dangerous to using the S word right now, I will say, about the fan base. I do think you're right. I do think that
what S word is that? I'm sorry.
Spoiled.
There you go. Okay.
You look back at 2021, one of those seasons that you referenced, and you saw John Harbaugh's ability, for all of his other faults as a coach, to pull some miraculous performances out of some extremely shorthanded teams. And it's one of the few reasons why all hope is not lost, because Lamar Jackson is at least not known to be down for the season.
Right.
It seems pretty clear that Lamar is not done for the season. It would take a really, really surprising report to convince me that that's under consideration. Harbaugh's ability to get better than replacement level play out of replacement level players is a legitimate skill of his, given there are other faults. I'm not trying to argue that there aren't other faults that people have issues with. What I am saying is, in 2021 and 2022, he dragged rosters that had no business being where they were at the end of the season to the doorstep of the playoffs or in the postseason. And there were sometimes during, I forget if this was 21 or 22, with the rash of fourth down attempts and 2-point conversion attempts. But there was something, go ahead. So what year was it, Ken?
21.
Yeah, 21. There was something I appreciated out of Harbaugh's aggressiveness and we're gonna get it anyway. Just that kind of hard edge hoorah football coach that Harbaugh is really can come out in a moment like this, and that is where his strengths are to me relative to some of the fine grain detail play calling style things. So I guess that those are the two reasons why there's hope is that you have Lamar Jackson and you have a coach who maybe he hasn't been able to get the best out of some of his better players in the last few years, but he does get the best out of replacement level players like almost nobody else in this league.
All right. I'll leave that be. Nick, great talking football with you as always. Thanks for coming on. Tell folks where they can find your work online.
Yeah, you can find me over at Baltimore Beatdown. I've taken over as managing editor over there for Kyle Barber, really enjoying working with our staff over there. You can also find me on the social media site formerly known as Twitter at Nick, N-I-K, Noseball. I hope you come find me on there, chat with me, and I hope you agree.
Okay. Other folks out there, thanks for listening to the show as always. We appreciate your input. Really appreciate the contributions to hashtag film study mailbag. Make use of that. We want your questions. A lot of people want stuff on Friday morning GM. We're saving some questions for that, but that show gets heavily oversubscribed in terms of the questions, which we appreciate. That means the show's doing well. But if you've got questions about the offense and defense, I'm going to occasionally move them over onto these review shows. Nick, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Ken. It was great.
And we'll talk to you next time. Thanks, Doug.